I'm Thomas Mercer Hirsch. I've been writing some ABL code since 1984, been an application partner since 1986. Some years ago, I stopped selling my application and turned my attention to the problem of modernization and transformation of legacy systems. In order to transform a legacy system, you have to understand it. And so I've been various tools, and this one is the latest in the suite. What we're going to talk about today is a little bit about what the problem is and what our opportunity is to, in association with that problem. And then I'm going to talk about what is captured in the current tool, what's on the roadmap, and something about the potential for analysis here, although that's an extremely open-ended topic, as I think you will appreciate. So starting with problem and the opportunity, there's an awful lot of legacy ABL code out there, often millions of lines of code, and an application that may be 10, 15, or 20 years old. Nobody's documented it in most cases. In many cases, there's not much in the way of comments even. You might have some old hand around the place who's been familiar with the changes as they've gone on. Maybe the old hand retires, maybe the old hand gets a better offer. At best, and I will have some numbers later on that will show why this has to be true, that old hand really only knows a fraction of the application. So the problem with that kind of situation is that in order to make changes to a legacy application safely, you have to have a solid knowledge of the impact. If you look in one little corner and you say, oh, well, in order to implement this new requirement, I just need to do this little thing. All too often in a complex old code base like this, it's often poorly structured to boot. Making that change will break something else. And in the absence of a set of very complete regression tests, breaking something else will be something that you discover in production, which can be very, very ugly. And it's not uncommon in a case like that to actually spend more money fixing the mess that the thing caused than it took to write the original function or the change that you made. This is bad. In order to avoid doing that, you need to know and understand how all parts of the code are related to each other and how all parts of the data are related to the code. And having that information readily available in some way is a whole different world than not having that information and trying to discover it in the process of just grepping through the code and looking for references, looking, you know, what programs do I even look at? That, you know, you may start to say, well, I need to implement a modification to this function, and okay, I can look at the menu and find out what code that thing calls. That's pretty straightforward. But what happens when that calls some common routines that are used by 14 other applications? How do you find those 14 other places? How do you find, when you want to make a database change and do something in a table, how do you find all of the places that might be impacted by your implementing that change? So we do have a couple of tools that are standard with the product, CompileXRef and CompileList. They, of course, only tell you about one compile unit at a time. That can be a valuable tool. And in fact, if you're never using those things, you're missing out on some important information that you should be having during development. A few years ago, I taught a workshop here on analysis tools. And I started with CompileXRef and CompileList just out of a sense of completeness, and was astounded by how many people in the room didn't know that those things existed. And it's like, how are you coding? How do you ever find out that your transaction scope is wrong? How do you ever find out that your buffer scope is not what you thought it was? How do you ever find out that you're using a whole index search instead of the index that you thought it would pick? But that happens. And CompileXref and CompileList don't really have all of the information that you need, even about that one program. So you're likely to need some other kinds of sources of information in order to get a more complete picture. And in order to know about the application as a whole, you're going to have to put that information into some kind of database in order to have it accessible to queries and analysis that goes across compile units. There are a number of vendors who have built XRef tools in their applications. They are pretty much proprietary, so they're not accessible to people who don't have those applications. They are also often very old, so that they aren't taking full advantage of all of the information that's actually in XRef, CompileXref these days. Most that I've seen only use CompileXref, they don't use CompileList, so they're missing any of the information that's in there. So it isn't, it's a tool that is helpful to the people who have those products and who actually use them systematically. It's not a tool that really contributes to the community at large, nor is it a tool which is easy to extend to additional information. Hence, ABL to DB. Open source, highly modular, adaptable, extensible. It's been written in such a way that I have packaged tasks so they can be used individually, so that if you're some things that you're not interested in, you can exclude those. If the things you are interested in, you include those. Obviously, there are dependencies. You can't run the piece that links code and schema without running the piece that builds the schema and the piece that builds the code units. So there are dependencies. And there's a lot of stuff in there already. I'm going to be putting the release up on OE Hive when I get back. But I also have a whole stack of things that I'm going to be adding to it over the next few weeks. And so this is kind of release, 0.2 or something like that. And it's going to be a lot of stuff. And I'm really interested in people trying this stuff out, finding out if there's something in it that doesn't work. And even better, coming up and saying, could you possibly find out about this other thing? Because this is something that I'm really interested in. I had an exchange with a German fellow a while back who was interested in finding unused code. And it hadn't occurred to me to use this to look for that. But once we had talked, I thought, well, the information's going to be here. We're going to know what's not used. So what's in the current tool? First of all, there's the schema. The schema tables for ABL to DB are in regular tables, not in the underscore file, because what's in underscore file are the tables of ABL to DB. And so I needed to load it into separate tables, but those tables now have sort of like all of the columns that are in underscore field and underscore file and stuff. Even in cases where I don't really know what goes into those things, and in many cases the stuff won't be there. I will admit that the builder for that only implements those things for which I have a sample.df that actually contains the information. So there are some things like one of these days somebody will give me a .df that includes stuff for a foreign database like Oracle, and I will have to add those in. But the structure of that builder is such that doing that is a matter of minutes to add in any new piece. So let's go over to Enterprise Architect, where I have the schema, the data model built. And hopefully this will be slightly more readable than what was in the slide. The schema here in Enterprise Architect doesn't reflect the full schema of what's in there. It's only the part that's being actively used so far. So there's the DB table, indexes, columns, index columns, all of the stuff that you'd expect to see there because it's in the underscore files. So the next piece that tends to get executed is all of the source code files in the applications, anything that's a separate individual identifiable source code disk file. And this is an empirical test. You don't have to build this. You point to the directory and you give it, there's a whole bunch of parameters that you can set that will tell you that you can have it say this is or is not a source code file. So if you have the application that I have primarily tested this on is Integrity Solutions, my old ERP package. Well, that started off in life in 1986 as a version of VARnet. 250,000 lines that I got originally from VARnet are now 1.75 million lines of code in that application. Some of the VARnet code has been replaced, some of it has not. My intention was to replace the rest of it the next big sale I made, and that big sale never happened, so it's still there. And that means a bunch of things that are peculiar in some other code bases. Like they have .t files and .s files that are really documentation. We were using a tool back in the late 80s that helped design frames, and so those things went into .f files. They're really include files, but they're a special kind of include file. I have a tool called Specification Driven Development that uses specification files that are underscore M following the program type. So those are in there. And then of course the real joy was that VARnet, when they started off in their greater wisdom, decided they didn't like PSC's idea that a compile unit was a .p. So in their system, compile units have no extension. So when you find a file with no extension, the only way you know whether it's a compile unit or not is to compile it. And it either compiles or it doesn't compile. I mean, it's really nuts. But I have written code to handle all of those possibilities. And so I think that it's fairly likely that most code bases that will have their own peculiarities should be simply a question of setting the right parameters. So, and here the structure is that we've got a disk file. That's anything that's a separate recognizable file in the file system. It has no indication as to what its purpose is, and the compile unit and the include unit that get identified. The compile unit is created if there's a .r that goes with it, and the include unit is created that you create the disk file when you do the initial scan, The include unit is created when you find an include reference someplace. So if you have an include unit that has no, that is never used, it will not show up as a as an include file. And one of the interesting things, tests that you can run, of course, is to go through looking at the disk file and find out which ones of them are neither one. And then you're going to have to ask yourself, what is it and why is it like that? Of course, one of the things is that it could be a compile unit that didn't compile.
Hey, Thomas.
Yeah.
So that screen that you showed last, that is what your tool looks like?
No, that's Enterprise Architect.
That's Enterprise.
That's just showing the I'll talk more about this a little later on, but in order to run the application, take something about over a little over an hour with the code base that I'm working on. So I didn't think there was anything meaningful I can show, particularly since most of what it does is to just load up the database. It doesn't then turn around and do anything nice and visual. It does keep rather extensive logs about what it is that it's done. But it doesn't do anything interesting on the screen. So I'm looking at the information that's in the schema. When I publish this talk, I always publish my talks as PDFs, so they show both the slide and the notes section. And the slides that are now marked demo will get replaced by a full page size version of that diagram so that you can actually read all of the information on it.
So OpenAI, the architect, I've never worked with that. You provide a source file for an architect?
No, the architect stuff is manually built. There are tools that will build.
So it'd be SODA, you could generate without your tool.
Say that again?
Yeah, that's probably you can generate them in Architect without using your tool.
Well, yes, correct. Yeah. Correct.
That's just the tool you're using to build your tool.
Yeah, it's a tool I'm using to document what my tool, an aspect of my tool. And of course, later on, I may use ABL to UML to actually build the UML diagram of the empirical tool. But I haven't done that face yet. It then goes through all of the things that are source code and identifies everything that's a subunit, internal procedures, functions, methods, and builds a schema for that. And it's at this point that it builds all of the include root. It identifies something as being an include unit, and it builds links to show where all of the places where that include unit is actually used. I'm afraid if I make this too much, if I zoom in on this too much, then it will become even less readable. So a compile unit is basically is a .r. It's anything that is going to result in a runnable piece of code. A compile subunit is any of the function internal procedure or method. And then an include unit we've seen on the disk file, and the include reference is the thing that ties together the compile unit and the include unit. So it also goes through and from the list, the thing at the bottom of compile list, and identifies all of the block structures, every do, every for, every repeat, every procedure, function, and method, and a special block for .p's, or the word non-classes, for the main program, which is illegal in a class, but in a .p you can have code at the outer level. And in fact, in many cases, that's all there is. Or most of the code is out there. And it also picks up and records all of the transaction scopes and the frame and buffer scopes from that same listing. Yeah, this one I'm going to have to scroll, I guess. So we have the compile units. We have the blocks right underneath it. And then over here, we have buffers, scoped blocks, and then linked back to the table that they are a buffer for. If it is a buffer for a temp table, it doesn't record that currently. Only does database tables. And then frames are also linked to the blocks. It then moves on to run links, which is both run links and method calls. There are some interesting issues here. One of them is that the CompileXRF information doesn't include enough detail to tell you about to make all the right connections for a run of an internal procedure in a PP or SP. I believe that I have all of the information necessary in the database to do the analysis to identify that this run call occurred at that line, which is in this block and therefore is a part of that internal procedure, in order to be able to create the link from the internal procedure or to the internal procedure at each end. But I haven't written the piece that does that analysis yet. But I'm pretty sure that the information that you want is there. The other interesting problem is dynamic calls, things like run value. How important this is varies a lot from application to application. Anytime you make an application dynamic in some way, you've made it difficult to analyze. And this is also going to be true of dynamic queries, for example, that the information is just not there. With some forms of dynamic calls, I am capturing them and figuring them out at the time, because if you have a .p that runs a persistent procedure, and then you run something in that persistent procedure, while the XRF information doesn't tell you where the run actually ended up, it does tell you what it was calling. And I have a record of the fact that the persistent procedure is there. And of course, I've already run through and found out all the subunits of that persistent procedure. So I look through all of the persistent procedures which are in operation at that point, and if I find that, I'll go ahead and say, okay, I know exactly where this goes. If I don't know where it goes, then I'm still capturing the information that I can, and marking it as an unresolved dynamic call, so that we can do other kinds of analysis later. And I'll talk more about that for ways to go about both computationally figuring out what's the dynamic call resolves to, and when you can't figure it out computationally, to figure it out manually and have that recreated every time you do a new build, so that you end up with a complete representation. And this one is actually pretty simple, because we have the compile unit and the compile subunit, and there's a program call, and the program call says, you know, that's the calling unit, that's the called unit, or that's the calling unit, that's the called unit, depending upon whether it's a subunit or the primary. The next phase is table and column links. That's any reference to any table and any column in all compile units. It includes noticing those and flagging appropriately those that have that are creating records, those that are deleting records, or those that are just accessing a record. Which is anything that doesn't just delete or create. And at the column level, it has flags to indicate whether or not it's actually changing the value in that field. So you can pretty well reconstruct. There was another session where we were talking about, it was a lunch conversation, we were talking about the problem of row ID changing when you had a horizontal table partitioning and you change the value in a field that you use for partition, the row ID will change because it's now in a new place. And of course that breaks some things that depend on row ID. But with this tool on top of the application, you could do a study and say, well, what are all the places where that field that I'm contemplating using for horizontal partitioning are actually changed? And if it is changed in places other than where the record is originally created, then you can say, well, this is actually a bad field for me to use for horizontal partitioning. I should be using something else that remains fixed.
Do you have any way of telling if an update is part of a buffer copy versus an explicit assign?
I don't believe so.
I've written a very lightweight version of this, and so I see all these updates to fields, and then I go look at them, and it's, you know, part of just a blanket buffer copy statement. So I'm looking sometimes at things that
well,
it's good to know that, but it would be good to know in the tool that it was a buffer copy, right. So I may not have to look quite as deeply at it.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a buffer copy into a temp table, then I'm not going to capture it.
Right.
So it would have to be a buffer copy into a new record.
Right.
And of course, in that case, you are still creating a new record.
Well, we're updating the system.
Well, yeah, that's.
But I mean, in some cases, it's just a buffer copy. So I'm really, sometimes it's creating new records, so it's initializing.
Right.
You know, so it's, I'm not as concerned about those as I am about explicit assigns.
Okay, but it does seem to me, nevertheless, that if it ends up in the database, it's a change that you should be tracking. Yeah, I can understand. It might be interesting to know, but I don't think the information is there to do that. So this is, again, conceptually simple, even though it ends up being a fairly complex set of things. You've got the DB table on the left, the compile unit on the right, a table reference on the bottom that links the two, and then similarly a column and a compile unit and the column reference that ties them together. In addition to the actual source code and the schema, I think that it's important to capture some information about how the stuff is actually used and used in combination. So one of the things that I've done is to provide a structure that allows you to load in the application menu. Now, this is one of those pieces where I have provided a general purpose mechanism, and what I'm expecting you is to dump out a file in a certain format that we will load in as a part of the build. And regardless of how it is that your menu is represented in your system. So that one is fairly easy to customize to site because everybody does that in a different way. And of course, menu doesn't necessarily mean something that shows up on the user interface. You can include as a part of that pseudo menus, like a pseudo menu for all batch jobs or groups of batch jobs that you might run. So that you're not tied to what's in the menu file of your application. The understanding here is that a menu item calls a compile unit. That's what it does, is it fires off a compile unit. And from that compile unit, you can trace down all of the code that might be reached in the execution of that function that represents that that menu selection. And that cluster of stuff is what I'm calling a functional unit. Now, of course, the contents of functional units can overlap because of include files or common procedures or things that are called in super procedures. But I think it's important to identify this is the package that is all of the stuff that I might run into if I'm going to be working on this particular structure. So here, an app menu is a menu in the application. An app menu item is something that's on that menu. And of course, that can either be itself a menu, in which case it points back to the next menu in the series, or it can be a functional unit, because it's something executable. And the functional unit, the app menu functional unit, which represents the link between the menu item and the functional unit, points to the functional unit, and the functional unit in turn points to the compile unit. So if you're wanting to pull out a report of what are all the code that's included in this functional unit, you can go to the functional unit and then follow the tree down. So, how does this thing actually work? The legacy code base, as I mentioned, is a Barnett base. It was development was stopped on this at a point where there was no OO, so there's no OO actually in my current test base. But I figure the prime candidates for this are probably, in many cases, also non-OO. But there's no reason that OO stuff can't be handled by it. 496 tables in the schema with 6,500 columns and 900 indices. A little over 10,000 distinct disk files, 4,500 of which are compilable. And like I said, about 1.75 million lines of code. These are the timings that it takes. It's for each step in that process. Some of them are very fast indeed. Some of them are more like 20-minute phases. The total is about 1 hour and 10 minutes. I was interested to run the same test on my laptop because the laptop has a solid-state disk. And I thought that I might see a big jump because it would minimize the disk access. But in fact, it only made about a 10-minute improvement. It still took 1 hour. So most of the time that's taken by the heavy-duty phases in here is coming from creating records, not from from the disk access. This code has 150,000 blocks, 5,400 include references, 498 menus, a little over 2,000 menu items. 1,500 of those menu items are functional units, they're executable pieces of code. 15,000 links to tables, 77,000 links to columns, and 35,000 program calls. So, what's on the roadmap? That's what I've just shown you is there today. It runs, and I will be loading it up to OE Hive shortly.
So just for my understanding, what you do is populate database.
Correct.
Database.
Yeah.
By compiling and extracting the code and scanning through that. What's not clear to me is you're showing in previous slides stuff on architecture.
Right.
And it's not clear to me what the relationship is from what you're showing there and your database. Is what you're showing? What you're showing there, if I understand it correctly, there's no relationship right now between architect and the data.
No, the relationships that I'm showing you in the schema in Enterprise Architect exist in the database.
Okay.
So if I'm showing a link between two tables in Architect, that link exists in the database. So anything that you would expect to be able to do based on the diagram, you can actually do in the data that's there.
So right now, if you download it right now, you could write reports on the analysis database.
Correct.
That would be the idea.
Yes.
Okay, then I got it.
And a footnote, as I will mention again later, the motive in creating this thing was to create a tool which would be useful in its own right by people who just wanted to access to their information. But the other motivation for enriching it to the extent that I'm going to enrich it is that I'm going to use it as the source to my ABL UML tool, so I will be building UML diagrams out of the same information. Right.
In the database. So what are the similarities and differences between your analysis database and Roundtable?
I haven't made a comparison to it because, of course, unless you buy Roundtable, you don't have access to it. Right? I mean, there was an XREF tool in the Varnet code package. So if you had Varnet, you had some kind of, admittedly in that case, pretty primitive version of the compile XREF. But if you didn't have Varnet, you just didn't have access to it. So the motivation here is to create something that's open source that anybody can use, whether they've got one of those proprietary packages or not.
Okay.
And admittedly, chances are that somebody has Roundtable isn't going to be very interested because they've already got a pretty good tool. It's possible, I think it's quite possible that by the time I get done, I will have a significantly richer repository than they build. But so they could still be interested. But the motivation is going to be greatest for those who have no tool at all right now.
Thomas?
Yeah.
Do you handle .p's that are also in groups?
They would, yes. That would get in.
See them both ways.
Yes. Right. And you know, of course, one of the things that would be a trivial report would be to go through and say, what are all the ones that are both? And fix that. I will say that in running this thing, there are, you know, everything, you have to start with a .p when you execute anything in ABL. So there's a little tiny .p that sets up, that has all the parameters in it that you want to use that apply to all of the functions. Maybe I should have shown some of that, but it sets up the log manager to capture the overall error stream and that sort of thing about what it is that's happened. That calls a driver class, and the driver class is the thing that has one method for each one of those steps, and it calls them in sequence, and if you don't want to call one of them for some reason, or you want to skip it, for example, there is a step that goes through and does an empirical compile throughout the entire code tree, and it's there to ensure that you have .r's, .xrefs and .lists for everything. It's also creating the .debug right now. I haven't started using that yet, but it's. I suspect that I will end up using that as well. So it's a. But if you know that your environment is such that those things are already going to exist whenever you run this as a build, then you can skip that step. And it's trivial to do that. So, yes?
So you didn't say that, I don't think, but it is a focus database you're dumping this data into?
Correct, yes.
Just wanted to double check.
And I probably should say, I'm writing this code in 11.3, but I don't believe that I'm using anything that is, other than the fact that it is all OO. So you have to be, to some extent, semi-current. But I haven't yet back-tested to discover any version dependencies. Most of it is really pretty straightforward. So I don't think there's a lot of really fancy stuff in there. There's the SAX readers for the XREF files and stuff, because I'm using the XML XREF. But you know, we've had SAX readers for a long time, and you know, I used to try to build stuff so that it was backwardly compatible for a long time, and my attitude is shifting to the idea that if you're trying to modernize an application, you have to have at least one development database, a development system that is a modern version of the code, so that you're getting all of the benefits. Because if you're going to be moving it forward, you're probably going to want to start taking advantage of new features in the language and stuff anyway. So shared variable tracking, block resolution is that business of trying to map the compile subunits and the blocks together so that you can create all of the table links and the run links at the IP level. And as I said, I'm doing some resolution of persistent procedures already, but there are some kinds of things that I can't find. If program A launches a super procedure and then runs program B and program B says run X, and X is in the super procedure, of course, there's nothing in that compile unit to tell you where that might be. And in order to resolve that, you have to do what's called call graph analysis, where you notice that, you know, okay, I started with, you know, a functional unit, I started with this one, this is running, so this is running, that thing exists, I can go look in there and resolve that link. And then with the dynamic calls, of course, that's going to start with a dynamic call report, so you just find out what all the ones are that are unresolved so far.
Those have to run value off.
Yeah, right. And in many cases, depending again on your code base, you will be able to recognize how those things, what they're going to resolve to. Like, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Barnett code base, but we're absolutely crammed full of these run values where they take a number for the transaction type and a number for the cost type and concatenate it together to create a run name that then executes that transaction on that cost type. So any given place in the code that is encountered, you can detect the transaction type, and that means there are five different possible results of that. So it's possible to create rules to identify those things and resolve them automatically after you figured it out. And even when you've got to track it down manually by reading the code and figuring out what the values are, I'm going to provide a mechanism that allows you to export that information, and then the next time you do a build, that you pull it in, and those things are automatically going to be resolved for you. I might also mention that one of the things that I thought about with respect to this and ABL to UML is that some people have expressed an interest in doing incremental builds. And so far, I've decided to stay away from that because incremental builds are very problematic. It's very easy to do an incremental build and leave behind bad data. You know, so that if you have a program that calls A, B, and C today, and then you refactor it so it doesn't call C anymore, and you do a build that just focuses on that program, it's going to say, well, I need a link to A and B, and maybe I need a new link to D. But what about that link to C that now is no longer valid? That kind of thing can be very difficult to detect. And if it only takes an hour on a not too modern desktop to run through the entire code base, it seems to me that you can do weekly or nightly builds in order to get your information. They're much safer. and like I mentioned, the unused code report, that's going to be particularly interesting to run on this sample set of information, because I know perfectly well that there was a lot of trash left behind back in there and back in the 80s. And so Barnett put everything into a module directory, like AP, but everything was right into that. And of course, it didn't take me very long before I said, well, there's just way too many stuff, pieces of code in here. And I started moving things into subdirectories. So when a program would get worked on, it would get a new version created in a subdirectory. But I can't say that my programmers were always really good about getting rid of the old piece. So there's a bunch of crud in there. And of course, some of it doesn't compile, some of it does compile. But none of it's going to be referenced because it's not pointed to anymore. You know, the thing in the subdirectory is pointed to. So I can have a lot of fun cleaning up this code base. But I suspect I'm not alone. Um, And I'm going to be exploring additional tools, notably, I don't know whether you went to the session that Gilles Carré did on his source code analyzer, but one of the things that he's done is to put a wrapper around the parser that comes in PDSOE. So once he and Progress get all of their legal stuff together, and he goes far enough to actually convert that so that it's accessible in as a .NET piece instead of a Java piece, I will start exploring what it is that I can extract out of the data using this parser, because that's going to be a much richer source of information than in the XRef or the list file. And both Shields and I have a contingency plan that if they don't get it figured out, then we'll go back and look at ProParse and see if we can't bring it up to version 11 syntax and make it the basis of for both tools. So what are you going to be able to do with this? The list is I think, extremely long. Obviously, there are all kinds of interesting, just little casual queries that you could write up. But I'm going to create a number of reports to give you a head start for common kinds of functions. And obvious questions are impact analysis reports. I'm going to do a change in this table. What is all of the stuff that I need to look at to see whether or not it's affected by that, and how is it being accessed in that place? And similarly, with the change to the code, what is all of the other code that accesses that? One of the things that one of the companies that's using ABL to DB to UML. One of the purposes for having it is in order to be able to refactor their application progressively into a service-oriented architecture. And in order to do that, one of the things you want to do is to look at what are clusters of related code and what in that grouping is common code that you need to separate out so that it's not actually a part of the service but can be identified as a separate piece. And of course, just simply giving you a report that says, here, I'm going to go work on customer maintenance. Show me a picture of what all the stuff is that's what all the pieces are that I need to pay attention to when I'm considering working on this piece of code. And as I mentioned, it's also going to be a new source, a new open source and free version source to ABL to UML. ABL to UML builds a UML diagram, a component diagram of a legacy application as built. It has all of this same information and then some in it. There's a few pieces of analysis that I'm going to have to go through in order to get all of the same information, but I'll be doing that in order to create that. And I think they're going to be nice complements to each other, because in some cases the easy thing to do will be to run some report or some query, and in other places the easy thing to do will be to go look at the diagram so you can get the big picture in a visual graphic kind of way. And of course, one of the reasons that I'm interested in all of this stuff is not just for routine maintenance of legacy applications, although I know that many of you, that's all you get to worry about, and I think it will be useful for doing that. But I'm particularly interested in transformation to a modern application, and this is the kind of data and information that you need in order to be able to do that work and to do it with some understanding. So, to summarize, the current version has a lot of important information about the code and the data and the relationships between them. There's a clear roadmap and a clear path to further expansion and refinement of that information. The structure has been built ideal for that expansion. Very easy to clip in additions, and in fact, the stuff that's there is also easy to extend and amend, like adding new stuff for the .df and use a piece of cake. and things like one of the functions attempts to collect a description for every disk file. Now, you may or may not have such a thing, but there are a lot of code bases that have some kind of block, comment block at the top, that has a nice description in it. Exactly what that looks like will vary a lot from code base to code base. But I've got a routine that goes through and looks through the code, and there's one little tiny, clearly identified block of code in there where I tell you, this is what you need to change depending upon how it is, you know, whether you want to pick up the fifth line or you want to pick up the line that has the word purpose in it, or you want to just pick up the first line of the program, or any of those kinds of things that you can do that there's a nice regular way that you can pick up that description. There's the mechanism, and I've told you exactly how to do it. It's very straightforward. And which goes through the theory, this is open source. It's going to be on OE Hive, and keep extending it on OE Hive. If anybody wants new stuff, I'll add new stuff. If they want to contribute new stuff, I'll add that in as well. I've borne in mind easy tuning to differences in code bases. Anything that I know about, as I start to get people applying it to their own code base, and they say, "Oh, well, you know, we have this particular thing." I'll accommodate that somehow into the process. So a couple references. The node exists on OE Hive for it. Right now it says, stay tuned. So it doesn't actually have much. And there are a bunch of related presentations on my website. So questions? Or have you asked them all already?
I just want to be clear, is this working against a single database, or like if you have a multi-database application, how is it?
The current structure works off of a .df, okay. Not out of a database connection. So you put into that .df everything that matters. Now it happens, for example, in my application, way back in when God was a young woman, and we didn't have temp tables yet, we created a thing where there was a sort database. And for reporting, complex reporting purposes, you'd attach a copy of this sort database, load up the fields in this generic file, and then read the field in order to produce your report, and then throw away the database. Disconnect and throw away the database. So the schema that I'm loading includes the schema for both the main database and the sort database. It also includes the meta schema because there's a bunch of code in my software that accesses the meta files directly. So I had to have that in there. So there's three different sets of schema in there in the one that I'm testing.
So Thomas, now that you've built this very sophisticated
tool to analyze your own code. What grade
would you give
yourself? 8 questions. I have already admitted there is a great deal of crap in there. there are a few areas which are, I wouldn't be unhappy to look at again. They're not OO, so they're not the way that I would do them now, but they do make good use of super procedures and stuff, and I was starting to implement some of those things more broadly in the code when I discontinued working on the application. There is a lot of code in there that doesn't look very pretty, but it works really well because it came out of the specification-driven development tool. And it has a somewhat peculiar architecture, because the architecture was very suitable to implementing it. And I don't know, well, I wouldn't write code anything like that now, today, because I wouldn't write procedural code today. So I don't know how to evaluate that in context, you know. Yeah, so.
I wasn't serious.
No, but actually I will say that one of the things that I'm happy about is that the code is as crappy as it is, because that's providing me with a lot of tests. and the only bad part is that it isn't, you know, maybe somewhat richer in IPs and stuff. There's an awful lot of dot P's that have no internal structure whatsoever. The only good part is they're fairly small. You know?
So does it work on Unix?
Yeah. No, there's nothing about it that's when there's no OS commands or any of that kind of stuff here.
Going back to the multiple database issue, if we have multiple databases, we need to get into them and put it into one giant EF, or can you load multiple EFs to get into them?
Right now, it's set up to do it as in a single load, just because it's something easier. It really wouldn't be very hard to call the same function three times with a different set of arguments.
Wouldn't it be easy to write both configurations?
Yes, in fact, the old ABL to UML did read it directly out of the schema, but that has that problem of how do I switch, you know, do I know what all the databases are and that sort of thing. If that turns out to be a big requirement, I'll certainly do that. Because I mean, I really actually already have the code to do it in ABL to UML.
Because of the
user
development, I guess our progress software is social. We don't need a code
to. There's no problem dumping the DF for the metascheme.
So I got that kind of thing.
Okay, I think we've run out of time. So I guess that'll be it.
Do you have a call?
Yes.
Because one of the projects that we've never seen in the history, we have all this optional code, and you have looking for, and like, I mean, it's really tedious looking for, like, all the run values.
Been there, done that.
Yeah, and maybe you know Jerry Sharon from Stack Building Supply?
No.
Okay, I will tell him a little about